Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 13th, 2012. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about meteor streams, and in particular, a couple meteor streams that are passing by the Earth this week. Now, meteor streams are small pebbles of rock, typically very small. And we have two comet trails that these are the result of comets passing in orbits around the sun, and they leave a meteor stream. In the outer space, they're called meteorites. They're little pebbles, sometimes the size of a pea or smaller than a baseball. A baseball would be a very large one. Most of them burn up before they ever hit the ground, but they come streaking through the atmosphere at high velocity. Many people call them shooting stars. And the ancients used to think that they caused diamonds, or that they were the source of pearls, all kinds of wives' tales, so to speak, regarding meteor streams. But the fact is that this week we have two meteor streams that Earth is passing through. And so if you go out at night, you'll see these little streaks of light racing across the sky. Most of them burn up before they ever hit the ground. And some of them, the bigger ones, the size of maybe a golf ball, would be very bright, and they would go all the way to the ground and then hit the ground. And people will go out and actually try and find these, which they sometimes do. But anyway, that'll be the main science topic. And then I wanted to include a bit a topic about larger ones, because the typical comet that we see in the solar system is very small. Where do these actually come from? What's the standard story out there with standard science? And what's the real story? So remember that standard science is a series of what I call fairy tale science. And with every piece of fairy tale science, they need other subordinate fairy tale science theories, and so such is the case with meteor streams. Anyway, main science topic, I'll be talking about meteor streams in general, where they come from, and then a few particulars about the meteor streams we're going to see this coming week if you go out at night. First of all, something very, very, very interesting crossed my desk this week, and I want to review this. Now, I see everything on the laundry list as far as conspiracy theories. There's a lot of nutcase stuff out there. There's a lot of goofy stuff. There's a lot of stuff that just doesn't add up, a lot of hip pocket theorizing about everything under the sun. But this particular story caught my attention as something that is very real, and of course I've heard things like this before, but this is the first documentary that I really, really put some credence in, and this is regarding the Titanic. Of course, we're all familiar. There was a famous Hollywood movie recently, the past few years, regarding the Titanic. I love the movie. It's just a very a touching movie, very popular movie, beautiful music, and regarding the Titanic. But at any rate, this particular documentary has proposed a case, and I looked at the video. It's about an hour long, and so just so you can follow up on this also, it's on a website, www.veteranstoday.com, and then it's /2012/12/05. Was the Titanic deliberately sunk by J.P. Morgan video? Anyway, I'm sure you can look that up, veteranstoday.com. And then the title of this from December 5th posting, was the Titanic deliberately sunk by J.P. Morgan? And then it's a video. So at any rate, here's the story, and I'll just briefly go through this, the argument that's made. It's extremely well done. The material, the historical data is very precise. And I would have to go check all of this data myself to give it 100% stamp of approval, but it looks very factual. Anyway, here's the story. When the Titanic was built, it had a sister ship that was built right next to it called the Olympic. And now this is very common with shipbuilding, that you build two ships identical at the same time, just for it's just kind of a more efficient way to build. When I was in Tulane University, I was getting my graduate studies in physics at Tulane University. I used to go down to the shipyards in New Orleans, and they would build big ocean-going ships down in the shipyards at New Orleans. And it was very standard to see two ships being built side by side, and they'd take one piece of steel and put it on one boat, and on the other boat right next to it would be the same piece of steel. So everything was placed two at a time, not one at a time. Simply a little bit more efficient process. Okay, so anyway, thus it was with the Titanic. Its sister ship was the Olympic. The Olympic was finished first and was put into service. But the Olympic had a pretty tough life. It had quite a few accidents at sea, the last of which rendered it in very poor condition and unseaworthy in terms of long-term usage. It had a bent keel. It had a slight list to port, as they were saying. So it had a damaged right propeller shaft. The right propeller had to be replaced. And so as this boat was being, as the Olympic was in dry dock being repaired, they were taking pieces of the Titanic, including a propeller, and putting it on the Olympic. And so anyway, the person that was recounting all of this history, plus all of the accidents of the Olympic, oh, it was very convincing. I am personally 100% convinced by this video as far as distributing it to the public and putting my 100% stamp of approval on for general distribution. I would caution that, as I would do with anything, because I haven't had the time and probably won't have time to check all of the data, all of the facts and figures of this video. But at any rate, I want you to go, when you get a second, go and look at this. It's, once again, it's on the website Veterans Today. That's veterans, plural, today, all one string, .com, veteranstoday.com. And then the issue date of this video is December 1205, so the 5th of December 2012. Was the Titanic deliberately sunk by J.P. Morgan video? And it presents a very interesting case. But remember that there were a lot of extremely wealthy people on that boat, thinking it was the Titanic, when in fact they had switched, and it was actually the Olympic that sunk, and then they switched the nameplate, and so as the years and decades went by, the Olympic was a main cast of characters on the White Star Line. And that was later commissioned in World War II to carry a troop carrier, etc., but made, of course, countless passages. The only thing I was not clear on in this video was what actually sank the Titanic, because it was very clear that all of the fables about the Titanic, that it hit an iceberg, and I always wondered that too. It seemed a bit odd that a glancing blow from an iceberg would sink and tear open a boat the size of the Titanic. It wouldn't just kind of slide by and pass through the sea. They made the case also that, this is what we always heard, is that the captain of the so-called Titanic, which turns out to be the Olympic, was racing to get to New York to set a new transatlantic speed record and make headlines and hit the iceberg at full speed. That argument doesn't hold water, because in the actual hearings of the Titanics, all of the ship captains of the time said they had no reservations of moving through an ice field at full speed in the middle of the night with their ships. They did it all the time, they said. So this argument that the Titanic was breaking the rules of seamanship by going too fast, they said that's a bogus argument. But anyway, I'd like you to go watch that. But remember that that was a time that was very formative in the United States. Okay, the Titanic, 1912, a lot of very wealthy, prominent philanthropists went down with the Titanic, and in 1913 ushered in the banking era of the Rothschilds, who took over, and of course that led the way for World War One, which was the first major war in the endless series of wars that we've seen, funded and controlled by the European bankers. So at any rate, but it's a good piece of history. It's a very solid argument that the boat that sank in the Atlantic was not the Titanic. It was the Olympic, the sister ship of the Titanic. And I want you to, and now you have to step back and say, well, what really hit that ship? And it appears that some smaller ship was there to basically sink the Titanic. And the amount of intrigue and the amount of unanswered questions there, it leaves a number of unanswered questions. For example, why was the California positioned 12 miles away? Because it was supposed to be there to save the people of the Titanic, but it was not. It was 12 miles away, so it couldn't possibly have seen the distress signals of the Titanic and come to save the people. At any rate, it's a very complicated story, but it also hints of the fact that not only did J.P. Morgan and the boys sink the Olympic in place of the Titanic, but they also deliberately killed a lot of the philanthropists who were independent of and allowed the European bankers to come in unobjected, unobstructed, to set up the banking system that we now have in the United States, the Federal Reserve, along with the taxation system that it was put in place at the same time. So anyway, I want you to go see that, a very interesting piece of history. But of course, one of the major also it shows what these people, the length they will go to get their way, to get their policies in place. Okay, so tonight, the next little segment here, I'm going to spend talking about the 2012 hoax and the NASA white horses riding in this week, CNN running two major articles side by side regarding the end of the world 2012 craziness. And of course, the NASA out there, the white hat NASA guys, just fighting a tooth and nail. Hopefully there won't be any suicides. But I saw a very interesting twist. Remember, I criticized, I know NASA guys are out there listening to me. I think it's real fun to see them adjusting as I announce this stuff on my radio show. But last week, I concentrated on the fact that in the David Morrison stories regarding him receiving emails, he concentrated on youth and youth suicide. And this week, the stories have dropped the youth suicide part. In fact, the CNN story completely reverses that and says that no youth have contacted David Morrison, only adults regarding suicide. I thought that was an extremely interesting twist in the NASA lie, the NASA cover story, regarding 2012, the end of the world, the Mayan calendar, and all of that craziness. And I think it's odd, too, that right now I'm in a series, a six-part series with History Channel 2, and I'm featured in many of these. In fact, I'm in all of six parts of this series. But the series does not, to my knowledge, ever talk about 2012 and the end of the world. It says that we are entering the beginning. The countdown is beginning right now to apocalypse. In other words, and it's simply talking about prophecies, the Hopi. It talks about Nostradamus. It talks about, and to my way of viewing, Given the conditions and given the History Channel and everything else, I thought the series was fairly well done. Although, of course, I have my own version of how everything should be in the universe, and not everybody is aware of my work. Not everybody is attuned to my work, and so it's like swimming with the sharks. To get my message out there, or even a little piece of my message, I had to allow my message to be somewhat reduced in scale. But what does it do? It gets my name out there. Now people know, more people have access to my information and name. Now they can come to my webpage and listen to my full story. And so in that sense, I see it as a benefit. Of course, I would have loved to have 6 hours, all six pieces of the series to talk about my work, but that's not the way it works in the real world, or just say when I go on Coast to Coast AM. I can't claim that everybody on that show agrees with me or that I talk about everything that in agreement with everybody else. I'm a guest on a radio show and I'm one person, but it allows me to get my message out there, and I know for a fact that when I'm on Coast to Coast or when I'm on many other radio shows as a guest, the numbers go up. People want to hear what I say. The number of listeners dramatically increases. And so I know people are out there listening. They know what they like what I say, and that brings people to my webpage as steady listeners. Now I got a captive audience. Now I can listen. In fact, it's rather humorous that there's an edict that went out, and it had to be some time ago, but the webpages that try and detract from me or try and slam me have a rule. They will not allow my name or webpage to be announced or used in any shape or form in the blogs. Only the guy who's in charge of the page can badmouth me, but they don't want my name included in the blogs because that brings more attention to my webpage. And as in Hollywood, they say, a lot of movie stars have what they call bad publicity. They do something or they have some bad publicity about their name, but the movie stars love it. It doesn't matter if you say something good or bad, it's got their name out there. It's free publicity. And in a sense, that was what was happening with me. The bloggers would write in, and then the head of the web page would try and cut me down and say bad things about me, but it was... What did it do? It drove people to my webpage. I sold books. I sold water filters. People came to my page because of their bad-mouthing me. So as Henry Ford said, you say something bad about Ford, say something good about Ford. I don't care what you say, just make sure you say Ford. And so that was what was happening. So it's rather comical to see that people are blogs that are bashing me, don't allow those blogs to use my name or to post my webpage because it's free advertising. And I even saw a blog by one guy, one of my main detractors, who said exactly that. He said, you're not permitted to use this name because it's like promoting that person. It gives them free promotion. But anyway, I thought that's rather comical. So as with any of this, keep those cards and letters coming. And as I rather comically joke with a friend of mine every year, this year I have not yet gotten my Christmas card from NASA yet, again. I've waited every year for the past 15 years for my Christmas card from NASA, and doggone, it hasn't come again. And I'm just distraught. So maybe there's still hope this year, though, that I'll get a Christmas card from NASA. But at any rate, that's one of my major goals in life is to get a nice, warm Christmas card from head of NASA or at least one of the scientists out there, maybe David Morrison. At any rate, and by the way, let me just comment on David Morrison. I debated him. On the Coast to Coast AM radio show, we had a debate regarding the scientific correctness of Venus becoming a large comet and then becoming a planet. And I won that debate with a call-in vote. Like, I forget what it was. It was 50 in the low 50s, my side, to the high 40s on David Morrison's side. But prior to that, I had a chance to speak with him. We spoke numerous times before the debate to set the ground rules of the debate. That was part of the debate. And so we had a very congenial rapport. And I must say that. And so David Morrison is trying to do the best job he can, given his background, etc. He was a student of Carl Sagan's. And, of course, I was on the faculty of Cornell University while Carl Sagan was still there. Carl Sagan, actually, when I was at Cornell, Carl was becoming a movie star off doing the Cosmos series, and he had substitutes teaching his astronomy class. That was one of the big claims of fame of Cornell University, is that when the students went there, they took their general astronomy course from Carl Sagan, and it was a big draw. It was quite the thing to have Carl giving your astronomy class in person. But when I was there, he was off in L.A., with making the Cosmos series, which was, I forget, a many, 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 many parts series with Carl S. Starr. And so, anyway, I met a lot of the NASA scientists there, but I never quite had the opportunity to meet Carl. But maybe that's for the best. Okay, anyway, I also am going to make a point to enumerate the hoaxsters, the 2012 hoaxsters, who many of them borrowed my material and, of course, changed it, modified it into goofiness, and that part of that was to take my work and make it into something of a nutcase type of presentation, publish it in books, and, of course, this was all backed by the government. And, of course, that's my biggest point, is that this was all a giant dog and pony show. And so the point of this, and I made a posting on my webpage, I said, was there ever a possibility of all of this happening in 2012? And I said, no. I said, was there any basis to this happening? And the answer is no. And the short of it is that this whole 2012 end of the world Mayan calendar, Nostradamus predicts the end of the world, every other thing in the kitchen sink thrown in, Planet X, Nibiru, was all a government-sponsored disinformation ploy. Now, when I say government, does that mean Obama or Romney or some political figure? No. These are think tanks that really work, and you have to understand that our federal government is just a puppet government run by the European bankers. And so now you have to understand what the real circle of influence is to drive these false concepts into the heart of the public. Then the NASA white horses come riding in to save the day with their Tier 2 science, and this is what the public sees. This is what is presented to 99.9% of the public. And like I said, CNN now is pounding that two back-to-back articles right on their main list of top articles for the week talking about debunking the 2012 end of the world scenario, and that when this is over, then nobody should ever talk about Nibiru or Planet X or the end of the world or anything else at all. And so they talk about the Heaven's Gate issue, which was a mass murder, not a mass suicide. And NASA is very much influential in damaging or presenting completely incorrect information to the public. And so this is the flip side of the dog and pony show. Like, they are the experts, they come riding in. And I got to admit, the NASA story is a whole lot more palatable than the crazy internet end of the world 2012 Mayan calendar, all of that stuff. And by the way, the Mayan calendar never predicted the end of the world, ever. That was just a hoax started many years ago. But they used everything in the kitchen sink to try and create a ridiculous story, but to allow the NASA white hats to come in and save the day. And so that's the basis for everything that's going on now. And then they can point to December 21st, 2012. It came, it went, the end of the world didn't come. They're constantly referring now back to crazy lady in 2003, talks to aliens. They're referring to that now. She's out there on the warpath again, 21st of December. The Nibiru is going to come and destroy the world. Crazy lady talks to aliens. But what I'm afraid of is they're going to go out there and they've got some sleeper cells out there, just like this guy that shot up a mall in Oregon. These guys are out there. They're waiting at a drop of a dime to get that signal from their handlers to go out there, shoot up a mall or kill somebody or mass suicide, whatever it is, so that they have something to splash all over the front page of the newspaper. And I'm actually expecting this time that there will be suicides and it'll be splashed all over the front page of the newspaper. And that NASA is saying they're trying everything they can, but they don't think it's going to be enough. That there's going to be, you know, there might be some people that slip through the cracks and just don't believe the NASA story. So at any rate, this is the dog and pony show that's going on, but I guarantee you that if there are suicides, they're going to try and get Congress involved and say that nobody should be able to talk about Planet X without government sponsorship. You know, see where this is going? Okay, enough of that. But anyway, let me look through my topics here. I want to quick talk about the products that I have on my webpage. There's many new people. This is going to be less than a minute. The Recalendar Sunstar Clock. This is a very unique product to recalendar. And it's actually, you can use all of these products that I have, you can use them today. It's, if you set it up, it gives you the time and calendar today. And if we ever have any events, you can rebuild the calendar and time either using the sun or stars. And it's a amazing device, only $39.95 plus shipping. Then there's the pre-filter, something that you will find nowhere else in this corner of the solar system. Except on my webpage, and it's a canister that sits on top of your gravity water filter and pre-filters. There are powders that you put in there, they're medical food grade powders, and they pre-filter the water before it goes into your water filter. And there's a lot of people that use this every day, people that have bad water, chemical ridden water or minerals, high mineral content water. And then there's the modular filtration and storage system. It's a big canisters, 6.5 gallon containers. There's nothing like this anywhere on the market. Plus three storage containers, also of 6.5 gallons. They have screw top caps, and so for emergency, this is something that's absolutely essential to have a place where you can store and seal in your water. If there's dust, if there's wind, if there's a pollution in the water, whatever it is, you can store your water in a safe, sealed container up to 20 gallons. And so, at any rate, a very important product, modular filtration and storage system, plus all my books, DVDs, CDs, etc. Okay, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, short for jmccsci.com, 7 letters, jmccsci.com. S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com. Go there. And just a quick note, as we head into the holidays are a time of great happiness for people. Many people are with their families. But it's also a time of great sadness and great sorrow for many people. Because ultimately, when it comes right down to it, after all the presents are opened or all the presents are not given or whatever the case may be, it's really that we are humans, and the one thing that all humans seem to want, I hope this is the case anyway, is companionship. And it starts with the family, but there are a lot of people out there who don't have families. And so I think that's where a lot of the sadness comes in. And as a human race, we have not seemed to learn how to manage this, where we take care of ourselves, our own, And a lot of people left out there kind of to bake on their own. And so it's a time of great sadness for many people. But as a society, it's just one other symptom of a failed society where we don't have our act together. Some people are enthralled in purchasing, go to the mall and buy, use credit, whatever it takes to buy beyond your means, to give presents to everybody. And is that really buying happiness? When it comes right down to it, once again, I really feel when I, in, you know, just like everybody, I end up in a mall or in a shopping area, seeing all of the fanaticism, the purchasing going on, and I think, you know, this is just bizarre, because what it's really celebrating is the birth of a little baby, and I don't remember any place ever learning that this is supposed to be something where you go out and buy and buy and buy beyond your means, and then forget about the people who are lost in this shuffle. At any rate, hopefully everybody listening out there will be happy, have a holiday season, a tranquil holiday season. But I know that that's not going to be the case. So my best wishes to everybody, and that's all I can say. It's the world doesn't have to be like this. We could live in a world that is full of peace, full of love, plenty for everybody, plenty of food, plenty of housing, plenty of water. But we live in a world that's all twisted and bent and filled full of hate and full of people trying to maintain their power positions. And we live in a world that's run by fear and deception. Not a pretty place. Not a good indicator of the human race. Okay, on to the main science topic. Meteors, meteor streams, what are they? Okay, so basically the reality is that a comet in an orbit around the sun has a stream of rock, basically rocks, etc., that are basically associated with that orbit with the comet. Now, standard dirty snowball, ice ball comet theory, this is what's the misinformation passed off by NASA to the public, says that these are rocks and pebbles, etc., that come loose from the main comet and then follow along in the orbit of this comet. And so, at any rate, is that true? Well, no, it's not true at all. But what's the real story? Well, the real story is as follows. A comet is an electrically charged nucleus. This is a rock that comes into the solar system. And that's what my theoretical work does. It shows how the charged object becomes charged. And this was, of course, always the enigma, the very difficult thing to understand by professional astronomers, that there could be something charged in outer space. Because Chapman physics, the physics that is heralded today in the standard scientific community, says that there cannot be any charged, electrically charged objects in outer space. And the reason is, they say, in the plasma environment of outer space, any charged object would be quickly neutralized. Okay, so it'd be electrically, because the charge, the free charge in outer space would quickly move to cancel that charge. And that is primarily the case. But here's the situation. They didn't account for the fact that the sun has a differential electric field. This electric field is caused by a non-uniform current in the solar wind. And so basically, this builds up a capacitor, an electrical capacitor around the sun. And as an object moves through this capacitor, it discharges that capacitor. I always use the example of the backyard bug killer. It's two electrical plates, two electrical grids or screens. A bug flies in the center. You have a neon light. All that does is attract the bug. Okay, the bug flies in between the electric plates, and that's enough to discharge those electric plates and zap. It zaps the bug, and the bug falls down in the tray below dead. Why does the discharge always occur where the bug is? And why doesn't the discharge occur when there isn't any bug? Well, that's the whole point. The solar system works exactly the same. What the bug is doing is as it flies in, it's at ground potential, zero potential. It's flying into an electric field that's becoming greater and greater. Okay, and exactly what Chapman physics says is happening. There is a quick maneuver by the electrostatic fields to neutralize that charge, that imbalance of charge. So how does it do it? It sends basically a mini lightning bolt through the center of that object, the bug, and it kills the bug. That's the side product of the electrical discharge. And in the process, by the way, charges the bug up temporarily until it falls down and becomes discharged down in the tray below. But the other unspoken, unheralded point of the backyard bug killer is that it charges the bug slightly, and that's part of the whole process. That's part of the discharge process. Okay, so comets are doing the same thing, but a comet nucleus can be anything. It can be a large object the size of Jupiter. It can be a small object the size of a dust grain. And as it comes plummeting into that capacitor, discharges the capacitor, and part of the process is that it becomes negatively charged. How it does this is slightly complicated, not too complicated, but can be duplicated in the laboratory. So at any rate, the point is that we are a comet then is an electrically charged nucleus, negatively charged, and what it does is it attracts the positive ions, the dust particles in the region. That's the visible tail that we see. Okay, along with that, small dust and rock particles out there that contain metals are attracted to this electric field by what is known as the induced electric dipole force. It's a commonly understood force in physics. But here's what happens. You have a non-uniform electric field. The metal in the rock contains free electrons. Those free electrons try and move away from the negatively charged comet nucleus, leaving the side over towards the comet nucleus slightly positively charged. Now, the negative charge, which is equal to the residue positive charge, the positive charge is slightly closer. Even though, and it's equal to the negative charge, the electrons which have moved away in that little piece of rock, in the metal, in that little piece of rock. Okay, because the positive charge is slightly closer, it produces a slightly attractive force, more so than the repulsive force on the electrons. And so there's a net, very small force, but it's there. And acting over time in outer space, it attracts these rocky objects towards the comet nucleus. So they become, as the comet nucleus moves through space, they start to trail behind the nucleus. That's where meteor streams come from. Bunches, millions of little rocks, pebble-sized and larger. Now, the one point I want to make is when we have big comets, the size of Jupiter or something like that, you know, you're talking your Nibiru type of object coming into the solar system, they can, in fact, pull in major size boulders, big rocks, maybe the size of a house, maybe the size of a mile across or so. Big, meteors, asteroids possibly, minor asteroids get pulled in along with this same process. So a big comet can have some pretty major objects floating around in space along in its meteor stream, along with all of the other small objects. The vast majority of comets are little. Those little comets don't have enough wherewithal, they don't have enough electric field to pull in the big objects, so they're left with the small objects, and that's what we typically see. So in fact, when we see, for example, now this week, we're going to be passing, Earth is going to be passing through two meteor streams of small comets. And so the shooting stars that we're going to see, the about 30 per hour, that's about one every 2 minutes, if you look up in the night sky, if you have a clear night sky, go out. And it could be from one of two comets. We have the unusual situation where we're passing through the orbital residue of two comets. One is a new comet called Comet Virtanen, and we're going to be passing through its meteor stream tail. By the way, these comets are nowhere to be found. We're not passing near a comet. We're simply passing through the meteor stream residue that is left by the comet. So there's no probability or disaster scenario that we would somehow be hit by a comet nucleus. That's not the case. The comet nucleus is long gone, nowhere to be seen or heard from at this point in our vicinity, just the meteor stream. So when you look up, now when you see these objects zipping across the sky, remember that they're the size of a pea, or the biggest ones are probably the size of a golf ball, and they'll zip across the sky. The vast majority never make it to the ground. They do not make it to the ground. They burn up in the air long before they ever hit the ground, but they make a spectacular trail as they're coming in. And you can see the brilliant colors, and the colors are related to the elements in the rock, in the small pebble. So the meteor streams, the meteorites are the small pebbles themselves. The meteor streams are the confluence of all of these objects coming into the atmosphere at the same time. If you were an expert, or if you did a little bit of studying, you could tell which of these meteors belong to which comet by just looking at the location of where they come from in the sky. So at any rate, this week we're going to be passing through, once again, the meteor streams of Comet Virtanen and the Geminids. The Geminids are one of the common meteor streams that we see every year. They're called Geminids because they come out of the Gemini constellation. That's where they get their name, because they seem to be coming out of that constellation. But that's just the direction of the indicates the direction of the comet, the original comet, as it passed through this part of the solar system long ago in history. The history of that comet, and this meteor stream is just the residue of the rocks, etc., that were attracted to the comet nucleus, not let off by the comet nucleus, and the history of that comet. So, but as I said, one of the major points here is that with the big comets, say Venus passing by Earth, now, here's something that the indigenous people talk about. They talk about these big boulders coming in over in the Mideast. There are entire fields, massive boulders that came in from outer space. And the people talk about that. A lot of people were killed when these came in, and this is in ancient history. But it had to take a very big comet to support that large a meteor stream. And so that's another one of the positive proofs that there were such meteor streams. There, this is pointed out by Velikovsky in his books, that in the Carolinas there are a series of lakes, and they're long elliptical lakes. But at any rate, what it looks like is a vast stream of meteors came in, large meteors, and carved out those lakes as these big rocks or boulders came crashing in lengthwise, basically a long pass, and as they were deposited then, and so one could potentially verify that theory by finding the big rocks and the big pieces of stone that are out in the end of those lakes, somewhere buried in the ground out there, and the big pieces, the rock that hit and formed those lakes in the Carolinas. If you look at Mars, it's very interesting to see the meteor craters on Mars. Now, Venus, it is said in history, came close to Mars, Venus the comet, and basically relieved Mars of its atmospheres and oceans. I really have to be almost amazed when I see the pictures that are coming back from the Mars rover, the current one, and they show the hillsides totally eroded away by water action, yet NASA just can't figure out if there was water on Mars or not. The water erosion that was there took a very long time. This is not a weekend process. This is something that took hundreds of millions, if not billions, of years to form the surface of Mars that we see today, with the water erosion going on. Not just wind erosion, but water erosion. And so the atmosphere and oceans of Mars were taken off in a single night, and this is what the ancients saw and recorded as Venus the comet came by. And then, of course, Venus started working its way in, coming closer and closer to Earth. And that's why there was so much attention given to the planet Venus. Here again, the main Mayan calendar, is related to the cycles of Venus, not the sun, not the moon, not the end of the world in 2012, December 21st, not related to any of those. It was related to the cycles of Venus. And of course, it took hundreds and hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, for Venus to stabilize and for the final Venus calendar to become solidified in the Mayan codex. But now people don't want to talk about that because standard science says that this could not have been a possible case. This could not possibly have been true, that Venus could not have been a comet. I had the opportunity to talk to a priest a number of weeks ago. And it was just a chatting, and it happened to be the week after the famous New Testament line where the apostles asking Christ, they say, what's going to happen? Where's this world going? Where's it all going to end? And he says, okay, look. He says, when you see the stars, they seem to fall from the heaven. The moon will turn to blood. The firmament will be shaken. Look up into the heavens for the signs. He says, that's when it's all going to come down. And so anyway, it was at that same time. And so I was talking with this priest kind of about that Bible passage. And I said, by the way, what do they teach about Noah's flood? And I wanted to hit that specifically because that's related to something very clearly that came from above. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. So where exactly did that rain come in from? And what's the official teaching of the Catholic Church on this particular topic? And he kind of sidestepped the issue by saying, well, some of these things should be taken literally and some are more figurative. And he never really answered my question. And I never pressed it because I didn't want to turn a social event into a dogmatic attack on Catholic preaching or the stories that they present. But it was just, I just wanted to get a reaction, so to speak. But, and that was the reaction that, well, some of these things we don't really teach as true. And, but he never said specifically about the Noah event, whether that was true or not. But basically, yeah, today these events have been forgotten in history. On my latest CD, I talk about, it's an 18 hours of lectures, MP3 lectures, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. And in there, I talk about the Noah event. That's one of the hour lectures. I also talk about the Moses event, which was the Venus event. And so, just for new listeners, it's very clear that the Noah event was 40 days and 40 nights. Actually, if you look at the biblical counting, it looks to me more like 44 days and 44 nights of torrential rain that came from above. And this was not just in one place. This was all over the world. The ocean levels rose. There had to be great glaciation. The sun was blotted out for that time. And the vast majority of the Earth's population died. This was many thousands of years prior to the Moses event, which was the Venus event. This is what Velikovsky concentrates on. It's what I call the Moses event. The Israelites followed Moses out of Egypt. This is the movie that was done in Hollywood, the great Charlton Heston movie. The Ten Commandments was based on that story. And, of course, the seven plagues, some people say nine plagues, of Egypt. at that time were caused, and this is what Velikovsky is saying too, and I concur, that these were caused by a large passing comet. These are all very indicative signs of a large passing comet. That is something that I'm not going to go into more detail here, but if you want more detail on that, listen to my CD, the two CD set, 18 hours of lectures dealing with the physics of ancient celestial disaster. That's on my webpage. But very important here, and as I talk about meteor streams this week, meteors always contain metals. And so that was something that I found interesting when I did my early studies on comets and meteor streams. I thought, you know, it's very odd. There's all kinds of dust and little rocks and all kinds of things like that out there in space. Why do meteor streams only contain the meteors that contain metals? It's very, it's like 100% rate that when you see the, when you pick up a meteorite, it contains some level of metal in it. Well, there's a reason for that, because the dust particles that do not have metals are not subject to the induced electric dipole force and therefore are not caught up in this electric field and do not follow the comets. And so the end result is that the meteors that you see coming in, and this is why I talked about the colors of the meteor streams, the color of the that they light up. If you took a spectrometer and followed that and were able to capture that light in a spectrometer, it would give the characteristic spectral lines of the particular elements in that meteorite as it burned up. And this would be a great experiment for amateur astronomers, and I don't think the equipment would be too difficult to set up, but basically set up a series of telescopes to cover a large part of the sky and then funnel that light down through spectroscopic equipment and take the spectral analysis of the streamers that are coming in the night sky. This would be something that would be very interesting, and just show that every one of these has metals in it, basically conducting metals that have that are conductors. And that's the typical definition in, for example, thermodynamics. If you want to define what a metal is, metals are materials, or basic elements, that have high conductivity. So that's very important. Semiconductors have medium conductivity, and other solids have pretty much zero conductivity. But the metals are what cause the electron flow. The fact that electrons can flow freely in the metal allows the induced electric dipole force to work in the non-uniform electric field of the comet. There's also, I should mention, that at the same time as I was developing my comet theoretical work, it was very clear that there was some discrepancies in the redshifts dealing with galaxies, with quasars, with the sun, any fusion object in the sun, and even with comets. When Halley's Comet came through the solar system in the 1986 era, some professional astronomers went to South America taking very good astronomical spectroscopic equipment with them, and they took the spectrum of Halley's Comet. And what they found out, it was all of the spectral lines were redshifted. In other words, they dropped to a lower frequency and lower energy light. And so they never published the data because they couldn't figure out why a small comet like Halley's Comet, which had no gravitational field, clearly, its nucleus was 7 miles across. We had spacecraft near enough to Halley's nucleus that if it had any mass at all, they would have been able to detect that it was like some kind of high mass and it did not have any such effects. And so the end result is that there was no gravitational or other reason. We knew the orbit of Halley's Comet, so it was not a special relativistic redshift of any kind. The two known causes of redshift, general relativity and special relativity, could easily be discounted. in that experiment, but yet Halley's comet had a redshift. All of the spectral lines were redshifted. So the scientists that did that never published their data because it didn't make any sense. So anyway, I was seeing all of these convoluted arguments and data coming in, and I said this clearly, the comets are electrically charged, have a non-uniform electric field. There's an unexplained redshift at the edge of our sun. The quasars had very different redshifts than the mother galaxies, and they were very clearly connected in all aspects and all ranges of the electromagnetic spectrum with strings and connections. And so the question is, what's going on here? There had to be another source of redshift, and that's where it became clear to me, and as I worked in my theoretical work, that I called it the induced electric dipole redshift, and it was a similar effect where an electron and a positron in a photon of light were similarly attracted. They did not break apart, but the quasar, or the galactic nucleus, or the comet nucleus, all being negatively charged with non-uniform electric field, caused the redshift of light leaving that system, using the induced electric dipole force on electric charges contained in the photon. So that's, of course, all published in my work and well documented. But once again, that very subtle force of physics being the source of redshift to explain the redshift in both quasars and galactic nucleus. So it's a base property of the object with the charge on it. Comets do not necessarily have fusion going on in their atmosphere, but they're charged for a very different reason, but nonetheless electrically charged. Okay, so anyway, that somewhat brings an end to my lecture tonight on the source of meteor streams. So now just remember, this week go out and see these beautiful streamers as they come into the atmosphere. And some will come from one direction, some will come from a different direction, and that's how you can tell the difference between the original comet, whether it was Comet Wirtanen or the Geminids. At any rate, remember, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and all of my radio shows for years and years past are archived there. I know many people spend a lot of time listening to the past archives, which is wonderful. All of those shows are still as valid today as they were back then. All of them are educational, and you learn how the real world works. And as soon as you learn that, it's going to make your life a whole lot easier, because now you can make some real decisions based on real information. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.